Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 1, Text Number 11. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Nibodha Tatedam Ritam Bravimi Nibodho Tatedam Ritam Bravimi Masuyutum Devam Arhasi Aprameyam Masuyutam Devam Aharsya Prameyam. Vayam Bhavas Te Tata Esha Maharshir. Vayam Bhavas Te Tata Esha Maharshir. Vahama Sarve Nivasa Yasya Dishtam. Vahama Sarve Vivasa Yasya Dishtam. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Nibodha Tatedam Ritam Bravimi Masuyitam Deva Maharsya Pramayam Vayam Vayam Bhavaste Tata Esha Maharshir Vahatma Vahama Sarve Vivasayasya Dishtam. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. The Supreme Person, Lord Brahma, said, Nibodha, kindly hear with attention. Tata, my dear son, Idam, this, Ritam, true. Bravimi, I am speaking. Ma, not. Asuyitam, to be jealous of. Devam, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Arhasi, you ought. Aprameyam, who is beyond our experimental knowledge. Vayam, we, Bhava, Lord Shiva, Te, your, Tata, Father, Esha, this, Maharishi, Nard, Vahamaha, carry out, Sarve, all, Vivasa, unable to deviate. Yasya, of whom? Distam, the order. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. Lord Brahma, the Supreme Person within this universe, said, My dear Priyavata, kindly hear attentively. What shall I say to you? Do not be jealous of the Supreme Lord, who is beyond our experimental measurements. All of us, including Lord Shiva, your father, and the great sage Maharshi Narad, must carry out the order of the Supreme. We cannot deviate from his order. Purport. Of the 12 great authorities in devotional service, 4, Lord Brahma himself, his son Narad, Svayambhuva Manu, and Lord Shiva were present before Priyavrata. They were accompanied by many other authoritative sages. Brahma first wanted to impress upon Priyavrata that although these great personalities are all authorities, they cannot possibly disobey the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is described in this verse as Deva, which means always glorious. The power, glory, and potencies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead can never be diminished. In the Isha Upanishad, the Lord is described as Apapa Vidha, which indicates that he is never affected by anything materially considered sinful. Similarly, Srimad Bhagavatam describes the Supreme Personality of Godhead as being so powerful that nothing we might consider abominable can affect him. An example sometimes given to explain the position of the Supreme Lord is that of the sun, which evaporates urine from the earth, but is never affected by contamination. The Supreme Lord can never be accused of doing anything wrong. When Lord Brahma went to induce Priyavrata to accept the responsibility for ruling the universe, he did not go whimsically. He was following the dictations of the Supreme Lord. Indeed, Brahma and other genuine authorities never do anything without his permission. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart. In the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said, Tene Brahma Hrida Ya Adi Kavaye. The Lord dictated Vedic knowledge to Brahma through his heart. The more a living entity is purified by devotional service, the more he comes in direct contact with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Tesham satata yuktanam vajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. To those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. Bhagavad Gita 10.10. Lord Brahma, therefore, had not come to Priyavrata by his own whims. Rather, it is understood that he had been ordered to persuade Priyavrata by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose activities cannot be understood by material senses, and who is therefore described herein as Aprameya. Thus, Lord Brahma first advised Priyavrata to hear his words with attention and without envy. Why one is induced to perform certain acts, despite his desire to do something else, is indicated herein. One cannot disobey the orders of the Supreme Lord, even if one is as powerful as Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, Manu, or the great sage Narad. All these authorities are certainly very powerful, but they do not have the power to disobey the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Since Lord Brahma had come to Priyavrata in accordance with the orders of the Supreme Lord, he first wanted to dispel any suspicions that he might be acting as Priyavrata's enemy. Lord Brahma was following the orders of the Supreme Lord, and therefore it would be worthwhile for Priyavrata to accept Lord Brahma's order as the Lord desired. please repeat the translation. Lord Brahma, the Supreme Person within this universe, said, My dear Priyavrata, kindly hear attentively what I shall say to you. Do not be jealous of the Supreme Lord, who is beyond our experimental measurements. All of us, including Lord Shiva, your father, the great sage Maharshi Narad, your father and the great sage Maharshi Narad must carry out the order of the Supreme. We cannot deviate from his order. Omagyana tamarandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurum militam yena tasmai shri gaurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam shtapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam dadati svapadantikam vandeham shri guru shri yuta padakamalam shri gurun vaishnavamscha shri rupam sagrajatam sahagana raganatan vitam tam sajivam sadvaitam savadutam parijana sahitam krishna chaitanya devam shri radha krishna padan sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jigatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gorange Radhe Brindavanishvare Vrishabhana Sutta Devi Pranamami Haripriye Vanchakalpatrubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhye Vacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So Lord Brahma has come down and he's coming to give some advice to Priyavrata. And the first thing he says, for a start, he's kind of, he says, what shall I say to you? So he's kind of setting the tone. It's an extraordinary circumstance, really, that Lord Brahma should come down like this to speak to Priyavrata. And he knows he's got a difficult task ahead to convince Priyavrata to take up this rulership of the universe. So the first thing he says is, do not be jealous of the Supreme Lord, who is beyond our experimental measurements. So it's interesting, such a caution. This is the person who is prospectively the ruler of the universe. And Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, is coming down to speak to him. And the first thing he says is, do not be jealous of the Supreme Lord. So that's a very, it's interesting that we can understand from this that being in the material world means that we are subject to this contamination of jealousy and envy, and that this is the prime, if you like, motivating factor of the material world. We're motivated by jealousy, anger, enviousness. That's why we're here. And so the first thing Brahma says to Priyavrata is, do not be jealous of the Supreme Lord. And then he says that all of us, Lord Shiva, your father, and the great sage, Narad Muni, must carry out the order of the Supreme. We cannot deviate from his order. So we can understand that these authorities, these are very, very powerful people, very, you know, divine personalities who are able to do fantastic things way beyond the capabilities of ordinary mortal human beings. Lord Brahma is coming, and not only are they those four great personalities, these great authorities are there, but also many other authoritative sages. So this is a very serious, what's the word, representation, a very serious party coming to see Lord Priyavrata. And then in the purport, Prabhupada again emphasizes that these personalities, they're all authorities. He says he wanted to first impress upon Priyavrata that although these great personalities are all authorities, they cannot possibly disobey the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So I thought that was quite an interesting statement that Prabhupada makes there. That in the material world, we tend to see when we are confronted by authorities or when we observe the authorities of this material world, the tendency is for them to think of themselves as being infallible, you know, masters of their realm, if you like. And even sometimes we see that in ISKCON, in that when we join out this movement, we come kind of very open-minded to some degree. Of course, everyone differs, but in general, where we've come to learn something from this society. And in the beginning, we don't know anything, and so we are very much subservient to everybody because we are, you know, learning from everybody how to be a devotee. What does it mean to be a devotee? What is our situation in this material world? But as time goes by, we find our position in the society. And eventually, it may be noticed that we have some sort of managerial capability, and we may become, you know, we may be given a position, you know, to take responsibilities for something in the temple. And then, after a while, we may become, say, temple commander or the treasurer or something. And eventually, we work our way up through the ranks over the years until finally we may become the temple president. Now, we understand that Vaishnavas, that one of the prime characteristics of Vaishnavas is that they're always seeking shelter. If we look at the six Goswamis, Rupa and Sanatan, we find that Rupa was always taking shelter of his older brother. And although they're both pure devotees, there's no need to do that. But shelter seeking is going on. We see this is the characteristic of the Vaishnavas, that they're always seeking shelter. They're always, although they can speak very nicely on the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, they never want to rise above their god brothers or the other Vaishnavas. They're always very humble. They're always understanding their position. So sometimes when we become an authority, there's a tendency to think that now I've reached the top. That means that I am the most important, I am the most intelligent, I know the most, and therefore I can rule, you know, the temple independently. I don't need any help or advice from others. Of course, we understand also that within the Varnashram system, that the Brahmanas are completely independent. They are intelligent, independently thoughtful, and they need to be completely independent from any kind of control so that they can speak the truth. As soon as a Brahmana becomes under an authority in the sense of, what's the word, dependent, then his ability to speak the truth can be compromised. It depending, you know, there are different stages, just like there are different stages of devotional life. We start we start out on the very lowest, on the neophyte stage, Kanishta Adhikari, then Madhyama Adhikari, and Uttama Adhikari. So in the same way, you can be a junior Brahmin, a senior, or a medium-level Brahmin, and a very, very advanced Brahmana. So there are different levels of Brahminical realization. But ultimately, Brahmana needs to maintain a certain amount of independence so that they can speak the truth. You don't want to be in a position where you can't speak the truth because you might not get anything to eat, or you know, you'll get thrown out of the temple like this. So Brahmanas are there. Then Kshatriyas are there. Now, the interesting thing with Kshatriyas is that, contrary to popular opinion, you know, generally speaking, many devotees or younger devotees tend to think of Kshatriyas as being fighters, you know, that they're just fighters. That's what they do. They're fighters. But the fact of the matter is that a Kshatriya is a protector. And the overwhelming, what would you say, bhav or concern for a person with the Kshatriya Varna is that he cannot stand to see exploitation, cheating. And when he sees that kind of thing going on, he just wants to stop it. He wants to protect those who are being exploited, those who are being cheated. That is the overwhelming characteristic of a Kshatriya. It's described, Prabhupada describes how can you tell a person what is their Varna. And he describes that when the best way to do this is in school, when the person is a child, and you see them, first of all, you do their astrology, and you look in their astrology, and you see what is their bhav, what are the characteristics of this birth in their chart. And then you observe them playing, and you watch them in the playground when they're playing. And you can see, sometimes, I remember in school, when I was a child, some children will be bullies. You know, a bully is like someone who comes and picks on you and hits you and sort of, you know, for no good reason causes you trouble. And another child may see that someone is being bullied and they may come over and say, hey, don't do that. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? That's not nice. So you can understand that the person who is intervening to protect somebody, they have, it looks like they have the beginnings of a Kshatriya nature is coming out. Because this is the nature of Kshatriya. The reason why Kshatriyas kill is because they understand that ultimately, in order to protect, they have to make that ultimate sacrifice. They have to do that ultimate unacceptable activity to kill in order to protect. They don't do it because they want to kill. You know, sometimes you know, we might find someone who's got an attraction for fighting, but that doesn't mean they're a Kshatriya. The main thing with the Kshatriya is they want to protect. So, Jai Hare Krishna. So sometimes our authorities, if you become authority in ISKCON on whatever level, we have to understand that we need to take the advice from the Vaishnavas. We need to find some very advanced devotees who are have a good understanding of Shastra and take advice from them. Before we make our judgments or before we make managerial decisions, we need to gather around us devotees who are learned in Shastra and use them. You know, if we have an idea that this is what I want to do, then we can share that idea. Listen, this is what I'm thinking to do. I remember Kanambakananda Maharaj once was telling me how when he became a manager, and in his initial times as a manager, he would be reading Bhagavatam, he would be reading Shastra, and he would understand what needs to be done. And so, you know, he would call in devotees and he would say, okay, listen, there is something we need to do. You know, it's clear that we have to take this particular action. It's the Shastra supports it. The sadhus support it. Guru supports it. It's supported by all the authorities, so I want you to do it. And the devotee, you know, okay, maybe he agrees to do it, but when he goes away, he doesn't do the job. You know, for some reason or another, the action is not carried out. So then, you know, temple president calls him back in. Look, you know, it's clear, sadhu, guru, sadhu, shastra, they all say we should do this thing, so you should do. So again, the devotee goes away, doesn't do, you know. So what do you do in that circumstance? You know, do you, you know, what are your options? You know, depending on your nature, you may act in different ways. You may chastise the devotee severely, or you may try and force the devotee to do the thing because it's guru, sadhu, and shastra says it should be done. You know, it's clear this is the right course of action, yet the devotees aren't doing it. On the other side, it may be that I can't do it, that I'm the authority, and I know that guru, sadhu, and shastra says something should be done, but I'm not doing it. So Maharaj told me, he said that at a certain point, you just have to pray to the Lord. You have to say, look, my dear Lord, I know that in this situation, we should do this activity. I know that the guru says it should be done, that sadhu says it should be done, that shastra says it should be done, and yet somehow or another we can't do it, or the devotees aren't willing to do it. What can I do? I'm trying to fulfill your order. I'm trying to do the right thing, but for some reason or another, the circumstances are not allowing it. So in that way, we have to have that detachment, that, you know, there's this saying in English, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So we cannot force the devotees. We can even see with Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada had his intentions for our society, and he had a future that he was moving towards. You know, Prabhupada was seeing who Krishna was sending him. He was seeing the facilities that Krishna was sending him. And according to those facilities, according to those devotees, he was engaging the devotees in pushing this movement forward. But despite Prabhupada's very good intentions, devotees would make mistakes. Bad things would happen. Deviations would happen. Now, one thing that Srila Prabhupada didn't do, he did so many things. You know, he set up our temples with a secretary, with a treasurer, president. He created certain sort of managerial structures. He created a governing body commission. But one thing he didn't do was he didn't create the ISKCON jail. You know, we don't have any ISKCON jail. There's no room with bars in it where we send our deviant devotees to be, you know, punished. You know, this is an interesting thing, really, if you think about it, because we know that the guru gives orders. He gives orders, and we're supposed to follow those orders. You know, it's known a disciple has to follow the orders of the guru. This is a shastric injunction. If you don't do that, then you're a rascal. You know, Prabhupada was often used that word, rascal. You rascal. But he didn't create any kind of jail or any kind of punishment system. And this is the situation. It follows the same principle of you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. The principle of spiritual life is that it's voluntary. You have to want to do it. And the sadhus, they are expert in persuading us. You know, this Srimad Bhagavatam class is actually a kind of method of persuasion, whereby we take the shastra, we take the examples of the guru and the sadhus, and we try and use these to persuade the devotees, to please you nice devotees, please kindly consider the situation that you're in and take up these instructions. And this is exactly what's happening actually in this verse. Lord Brahma is coming, and he's coming to Priyavrata, and everybody knows Priyavrata has to undertake this rulership of the universe. And so now he's going to come, and he's going to give all these very good arguments and explanations as to why Priyavrata should take up this work. So, it's a very important factor to understand. And it's interesting, we see that actually many things happened in our society. We were discussing with some devotees the other day about the different deviations that went on in our society. And our history sometimes is a little dark in some ways. Although the interesting thing is although there were a few leaders that did some terrible things, while that was going on, there were still many, many devotees that were all doing very wonderful things. So there were a few bad apples in the barrel, but the overall continuation of the movement and growth of the movement was going on because there were always sincere devotees. Those sincere devotees may not be in the top positions. They may be in very low positions. But because they are there chanting Hare Krishna and sincerely doing their service, the movement continues and goes on and gains strength gradually, gradually. So, let me see. Yeah, so these great personalities are all authorities and they cannot possibly disobey the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, you know, we're looking at Narad Muni. We're looking at... when this statement, they cannot possibly disobey the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's a statement that the devotees are devoid of the propensity to criticize others. It's described that the pure devotees are devoid of the propensity to criticize others. Devoid of the propensity means that it doesn't even enter into the realm of possibility. They just can't do it. So in this way, these devotees are so devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead that this is not a possibility that they're going to deviate, that they're going to disobey his orders. It's just not within the realms of reality. It's not going to happen. And then it's described that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is never affected by anything materially considered sinful. So I thought that was also interesting, that this word sin, you know, the other day I gave a little presentation on the Amish, and one of the things that came up in their in that presentation was one of the Amish persons was saying that that they try to avoid anything which will make them proud. Because pride is a cardinal sin. So it's interesting that the Christians also have this in their tradition. You know, pride is a cardinal sin. And I was looking it up. What does cardinal mean? So cardinal means it's like a kind of a... it's one of the most important points. It's a very important, serious consideration. Cardinal sin means a major, major sin. You know, pride. Now, murder, you know, we can understand murder. You know, that's horrible. You know, you go and you've got some terrible... hatred for a person, or envy or jealousy for a person, and you go and you make a plan to kill them, and then you do the horrible act of actually, you know, causing their body to cease living, you know, by some horrible means. That, you know, we can clearly understand that's very, very sinful, gross, horrible, cardinal sin. But pride in the material world, who is not proud? Practically everybody in the material world is, but even the devotees have pride. You know, we understand it's one of the last stumbling blocks, pride in devotional service. So this pride, that's why actually it's a cardinal sin, because it's so pervasive, so difficult to erase, to eradicate from our hearts. And yet it seems to be in one sense harmless. You know, just because I'm proud, how does that affect everybody else? But we can understand actually that it's an offense to the Lord. That's why we're here in this material world, is because of pride, because of envy, because of jealousy. These attributes are so horrible. The residents of the spiritual world don't have these attributes. They're completely missing. Just like it's described that the pure devotee is devoid of the propensity to criticize others. He cannot do it because he doesn't see any problems in the others. The pure devotee, the Uttama Adhikari, he only sees the good. And actually, this is one of the most amazing things about the Personality of Godhead, is that even though a person can be so envious and so jealous and cause so much pain, even to the devotees, just like we saw the example of Jagai and Madai, so envious and so jealous, and they were causing so much trouble for the devotees. But when they finally realized their mistake and surrendered to the Lord, immediately they were forgiven. So like this, the Lord doesn't harbor any kind of he doesn't hold any kind of grudge against a person who is offensive, who is jealous, once they have surrendered to him. But the tendency is for the devotees is that if somebody does something to us, if somebody causes us some harm, or is making schemes against us, or is, you know, and we find that they're making politics against us, it's very difficult for us to forgive them. You know, we don't forgive so easily. It's a very difficult thing, especially when someone is maliciously trying to harm us. It's very difficult to forgive them, especially when it's an ongoing thing. How do you do it? But we can understand that It's something that we have to. It's a very deep anartha that we have to work on in our hearts to understand the position that we're in, the position that the others are in, and understanding that our activities and the situation we find ourselves in this material world is all as a result of our own previous activities. And that if somebody is actually making schemes against us making politics against us, saying things which are not true about us, we can understand that we deserve it from some previous activity, whether it was in this life or in a previous life, and that's why this is happening to us, and therefore we deserve it. And once we have that kind of intelligence, when we understand that this is happening to me because of something I have done, then it becomes, using our intelligence, it becomes easier to let it go. That, okay, I deserve this. Let it go. Forgive the person who's doing this work, and gradually take shelter in the Lord and understand that actually this is a temporary situation. You know, sometimes we are happy, sometimes we are distressed. None of these things are permanent. But by the power of Krishna consciousness, eventually they all become eradicated. And we are able to, when we become such a person that we are so attractive to the Supreme Lord because of our very beautiful nature, because we have a nature which is free from envy, free from jealousy. And even though, you know, we see so many saints in the world that were persecuted, even the story of Jesus, you know, when finally he's being crucified, he says, you know, please forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do. So this is the benchmark for saintliness, that we have enough intelligence to understand that what's happening to me I deserve, and that please, my Lord, somehow or another, save this person who is persecuting me, because they will have to suffer such a hellish existence for many, many births for the offenses that they're making. So the Lord is described as never affected by anything materially considered sinful. And this is interesting because we understand that actually the Lord is the origin of all goodness, and that the world that he lives in, the world in which he is visible to the devotees, is a world full of purified souls, where there is no envy, none of these negative attributes exist in the spiritual world. And we understand this is a reflection of that spiritual world, and it's a perverted reflection. And that's why attributes which have an original form of purity become perverted, and we become affected by them. So we have this kind of mundane morality due to our exposure, our conditioning of this material existence. We're always we're unconsciously conditioned. Our birth itself is given to us based on our previous activities, and then when we actually appear in this new young body, we are influenced by so many different activities, so many different things that we see influence us. And we are full of these misconceptions which have arisen from growth in the material world. So, you know, sometimes we may look at the activities of the Supreme Lord and we may see them as being mundane. But we have to understand that it's another realm. It's a completely different realm with a completely different set of realities. It cannot be compared to this material world. So again, our intelligence, we have to use our intelligence to understand what is the position of God, what is the position of his kingdom, and understand that nothing that the Lord does, it can never be considered sinful. Let me see. And then Prabhupada describes, he gives this example of the sun, which evaporates urine from the earth, but is never affected by contamination. So that is our situation, that we are actually very contaminated, not just gross contamination, but subtle contaminations are there. But by associating with the devotees, engaging in devotional service, engaging in sadhana bhakti, all these contaminations are dried up. They're cleansed completely. And the Lord has no effect He's not affected in by any way by our kind of foolish activities. And then Prabhupada describes how by constant devotion and worship, the Lord gradually gives the understanding by which we can come to Him. So this is also a very wonderful consideration of the Lord, that He is observing our activities in our life, and He's seeing how much we are prepared to sacrifice for Him, and how much we are making plans to protect our position. And the tendency is in the material world that we want to protect our position. You know, when we become adults and we get some family maybe coming, and it's a natural tendency. We see the birds, you know, when they're going to when they're going to produce eggs, then they very diligently prepare their nest. They're looking for things to prepare their nest. In Mayapur, we have this problem that these pigeons are always making nests in our front balcony, and no matter how much you try to dissuade them, they just keep coming back. You know, you might throw their, you know, the few leaves of grass or whatever it is they put there. You try and throw them out to discourage them, but they keep coming back. We have some doves in the front veranda. We've got pigeons, and the back veranda we've got doves. And the doves, they keep trying to make a nest on the fan, you know, and it's like you dissuade them, but they keep coming back, determined. So like that in the material world, we get a family, we become very determined to provide for the family and to protect what we have. You know, you make a nest and you want to protect it. You want to make sure that it's there for the young ones, like that. And it's a natural consideration, but we have to understand that actually, how much can we protect? Just like the one time I was looking out of my front little veranda area, and I heard this noise. There was a loud kind of tapping, and I said, what's going on? I'm sitting on my computer doing some work, and I hear this noise. So I looked out of the window, and there was a big black crow. And the pigeon, there was two baby pigeons, were sitting on the nest, and they were crouching into the corner, and this big crow was trying to peck them, you know? And it was this was like a mean-looking crow with a big black beak. And he was really persecuting these little pigeons, and they were like in the corner trying to get away. So, you know, in every in all sorts of different circumstances, we can see that there are these dangers coming. And we want to protect. But how much can we protect? And we understand, actually, that only if the Lord favors us, he will actually give protection if we surrender to Him, as He says here. Those who are constantly devoted and worship with Me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to Me. So this understanding, just like the Kshatriya, we understand that when it comes time to fighting, you know, in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, all these soldiers were armed with all these various weapons, you know, flashing razor-sharp swords, axes, maces, bows and arrows. And you're in the middle of thousands or hundreds of thousands of soldiers who are equipped with sharp weapons ready to kill you. And the Kshatriya goes into that battle. He understands fully that I can be killed at any moment in the most horrible way. And yet, because he knows that he's fighting for a good cause. You know, the battle of Kurukshetra was there to reestablish the principles of religion. And Arjuna went into that battle, the Pandavas went into that battle, understanding that this is for a good cause. But it's extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. At any minute, you don't know who's going to come up behind you with that sword and plunge it into you. You know, like, it's a very dangerous situation. And so the Kshatriya, understanding that Krishna is giving all protection, he goes into that battle and he just gives his utmost energy into fighting that fight. And he's relying completely on Krishna to give him the intelligence, when to turn, when to duck, when to dive, when to make this move or that move. Completely surrendered to Krishna. And of course, we understand the glory for the Kshatriya. The glory is to die on the battlefield. It's actually a glorious thing. Not that he wants to die. It's not that he goes in there thinking, hey, I'm going to die now. He's trying to fight to protect. But if he dies, he dies, and that's a glorious thing. He's not worried about that. Completely reliant on Krishna for protection. So in the same way as devotees, are we going to make our plans for our protection and completely rely on our physical plans, you know, our insurance policies or whatever it is, you know, that we are thinking that's going to protect us? Are we going to rely on that? Or are we going to, like Arjuna, just simply pray for the Lord's protection? We understand that when we're born, we're given a certain amount of happiness and a certain amount of distress. And Prabhupada describes that there's no need, there's no point in trying to increase our happiness in this material world, because we cannot. There's no way that we can increase our happiness, because our happiness has already been allotted by the Supreme Lord. So all we need to do is just try to surrender Him, try to follow His order, and pray to Him for protection. And then He will give us all protection, because He understands that we have surrendered to Him. And of course, that protection, sometimes by material calculation, it may seem that we face some loss. Sometimes we see the Pandavas were constantly in difficult situations, and sometimes it appeared that they were depleted or they lost in some battle or in some situation. But they didn't lose in relationship to their into their relationship with Krishna. That grew. You know, as they surrendered and as they faced difficult situations, their love for Krishna, their reliance on Krishna, their understanding that Krishna is their ultimate shelter grew stronger and stronger. So this is actually the ideal way. Once I was told that, you know, sometimes in devotional service, when things are going easy, we're not necessarily making very much advancement. It's only when things get really tough in our devotional lives that we can make a lot of advancement in very, you know, in leaps and bounds. You know, you can make a lot of advancement when you're in difficult situations where you have to surrender. That is the, you know, the Krishna is waiting to see how much effort we're going to put into, how much we really want to please Him and to gain His association. He's interested in that. And if He sees us making great strides, make great efforts to disregard our own personal situation, but try to reach out to others and help them, He becomes very pleased with that. So this is one thing we have to understand. I remember Gaura Vinaya Maharaj used to say that there is no room, in fact, I think Prabhupada said the same thing, there is no room for pessimism in the Krishna consciousness movement. There's no room for any kind of doubt or pessimism or worry. Because for a person who actually aspires to simply please Krishna, to know Krishna, one who is crying for Krishna's mercy, who's understanding, just like a child cries out of anxiety for the mother, if the devotee understands that here I am in this material world completely lost, please, my dear Lord, I'm crying for you to help me. When a person is like that, then the Lord becomes very, very attentive and gives His protection and looks out for that devotee. And that is actually, it's called, there's that word lolium, the intense desire to gain Krishna's mercy. Sometimes it's called greed. You know, we have to be greedy for Krishna. You know, too often we're greedy for so many things, but not Krishna. It's interesting how, you know, as devotees, you know, if anyone asks us, you know, do you love the Lord? You know, who's going to say, no, I don't love the Lord? Everyone's going to say, yeah, I love Krishna. I want to go back to the spiritual world. But when we're not put in that situation and we're just living our lives, we aspire for so many other things. You know, how can I get that new car? How can I get more money to get a bigger house or whatever it is? There's so many plans we're making to make our life more successful or more secure or more comfortable. And how much are we really thinking about just surrendering to Krishna and just giving up all our lives for Krishna? The Parivajrakacharya, you know, the ultimate sannyasi, he simply goes out, you know, he'll walk out of the door and just walk in some direction, not knowing whether he's going to get fed or whether, you know, he's going to get rained on or whatever is going to happen. He just walks out and he's just ready to preach, and he completely relies on the protection of Krishna. He has no other shelter. He just relies on the protection of Krishna. This is the ultimate stage that we have to reach. We see in Vedic literatures this. It's always comes to the point where the king finally, in the dead of night, gives up his kingdom and walks out to the forest to seek self-realization. So ultimately, that's the stage we have to come to. It's not that we should be irresponsible, of course. We have to be responsible. But we have to always use our intelligence to understand, what has Krishna given me in this particular situation at this particular moment? What are the circumstances? What are the opportunities that Krishna has arranged? And just be satisfied with those arrangements. And at the same time, strive, be eager to try to please the Lord. Because we understand that by pleasing the Lord, He bestows upon us understanding. When we, and of course, we do this through the agency of the spiritual master. When we are fortunate enough to find a person who we can surrender to, then we can understand. Actually, it's described that Krishna, when he sees the person, when he sees a person is sincerely crying for him, he manifests before that person in the form of guru. So the guru is a personal manifestation that Krishna sends to help us. And we have that great advantage that we can always go to guru to clear our doubts and to help us to understand. And guru, if he sees that we are approaching him in a surrendered way, then he'll bestow blessings. And this is how actually we get realization. This is how we gain real knowledge, realized knowledge. Sometimes devotees, sometimes we may become advanced in knowledge. We may study the Srimad Bhagavatam, the different various scriptures we have, and we may memorize, and we may even be able to analyze, and we may even be able to explain very nicely the purports. But without actually being surrendered to the Lord, this can amount to simply book knowledge. It's just a platform of knowledge, but it's not a platform of realization. So even though a devotee may be able to speak very eloquently on the Shastra, it doesn't mean to say that that person has actual realization of what he's saying. So that only comes when we actually surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, when we surrender to his representative, and we'll please them by our service, by our attitude. And even if we're very illiterate, if we can please the Lord through his representatives, then actually knowledge is bestowed upon us in a way in which we cannot understand. But it's a fact. We have to have that faith that the Lord will bestow upon us realized knowledge according to our attitude, our activities, the way we present ourselves. So we're leaving this morning, so I need to stop here so we can prepare for our journey. If anyone's got any questions or comments, yes. Yeah, it's conditioning. As soon as we are put into a material body, we're covered by the false ego, and and then we have a different identity. You know, we assume an identity which is different to the actual original identity. So, and that is the contamination, if you like. The soul is trapped in this subtle body, and from that, so many contaminations arise in the mind. And it's only when we go through many lives of disappointment. And the interesting thing is that it appears that we understand that after many, many lives, eventually we have a distaste or we carry with us a kind of collective memory. It's not a clear memory of particular activities, but it's an understanding that this is wrong. And of course, Supersoul, eventually, when we suffered enough and when we start to look for the answers, then Supersoul comes and reveals to us. And then these coverings are cleared away. That contamination is cleared away. So that contamination is this covering. And it becomes our reality. That's what we think we are. But when we, by the mercy of the Lord, and by pleasing the pure devotees, when they bestow blessings upon us, then this contamination is removed, and finally, we actually, even in this body, realize our true position. So it's a, you know, the fact of the matter is the soul is not cut or contaminated in any way, but it appears to be because it's covered. Yeah, it's an illusion. It's illusion. It's Maya. Yeah. Well, it's you know, we obviously, if we're well situated, then that's you know, it's always a happy situation to be in. It could be an auspicious situation, you know. We have to see what it is. But at the same time, the devotees, devotees never, they're always eager to help the Lord in his fulfill his desire, and so. You know, the tendency sometimes is if we're in a comfortable position, then we just take it easy, just lie back and take it easy. And we see that happen sometimes. Devotees become complacent in a comfortable situation. But, you know, we also have to understand that what may seem a long time to us is actually a very short time. You know, even this one life, you have to see it in the perspective of millions of lives, because we've had millions of lives. If we consider this life in the perspective of millions of life, this is just like a flash of lightning. It's described that this life is like a flash of lightning. So we may be, what's the word? we may be, you know, comfortable for 20 years or 30 years, but we're not going to stay comfortable forever. Now, if we are intelligent, we will pray to the Lord to help us to realize him, you know, not just remain in a comfortable position, but help him fulfill his desires. And so we may... you know, take up active preaching, do something, you know, rather than just lying around enjoying our wealth. We use that wealth in his service, and we take challenges to fulfill his mission, to fulfill the mission of our guru. So it's dangerous to just enjoy our fortunate position, because any minute it can be taken away. That we see that happens all the time. You know, in the Second World War, there were so many Jewish families that were very wealthy, living very nice lives in Germany. And then within like months, they were in concentration camps. You know, so you never know when the good times are going to come to an end. So, you know, we shouldn't be complacent. But at the same time, it's just not that you kind of dismiss that good fortune. You just use it in Krishna's service. Is that okay? Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.